This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/acast. That's burrow.com/acast. burrow.com/acast.
Hello and welcome to The Mentor. I'm Mike Boris. We all know this is like across us every single day. Plastic is everywhere. It's a massive problem, 100%. Just the other day when I was at the gym after I finished training, I ordered a protein shake and they gave it to me in a plastic cup. I probably held it for like 30 seconds. I downed the thing. I drank it really fast. But the problem is I finished the drink, but this thing's going to last a lifetime. And today's guest, Mike Smith, he hates this problem too. So he set out to solve it with his new business, Zero Co, Z-E-R-O Co. Now he's founded it and launched it in just November last year. So it's like barely 6-7 months old. They deliver home cleaning and personal care products direct to your door, minus all the single-use plastic. Zero Co is still deep in the startup phase, but it's attracting thousands, actually 30,000 customers across Australia, from Dubbo to millennial households in the inner city, everywhere across the joint. And I reckon it's because people want to get on this journey with Zero Co too. I do as well. The packaging is really cool. It looks good. It feels good. And if you jump on their Instagram, it's fun and interesting. And you feel good when you buy one of their products. From my point of view, I'm definitely going to use it. So my questions to Mike Smith is numerous, but like, how did you get on this journey? Take me through your process of being an entrepreneur, and what the hell was it, or where was it, that you finally decided you're going to solve a global problem and starting off right here in Australia, and how the hell did you raise the money for it? So let's get into it. Mike Smith, welcome to The Mentor.
Thank you for having me.
Let's talk about you first. You've got a pretty out there backstory. You know, everybody wants to know how entrepreneurs get into business, and your business is a new business. This business is a new business. Zero Co is a new business, relatively speaking. It launched, what, December or something, November last year. We'll talk about that in a second. But in terms of the build-up to getting into these businesses, like we have all these people who aspirational, they're working in various environments and they're sort of shuddering to think, how do I get into business on my own? You've done a few times.
Yep.
Take me through maybe your first crack at being an entrepreneur.
The very first one, Mark, was when I first had this little inkling about, that's a thing, you can do that. I was in high school and I played in a band, terrible, loud rock and roll music, 16-year-old. And the guys I played in a band with, we decided we're going to put on a show one weekend in the Christmas holidays to try and make some money. And so we went around to like the caravan parks. I grew up in a small town on the North Coast, went around to the caravan parks and put up posters and walked up and down the street selling tickets to this event we were putting on. And we ended up having like 800 people come to this gig. And so we made like $1,000, which when you're 16 is like a crazy amount of money, right? So we split it up between the four guys in the band, $250 each. And we were loaded, right? $250. And that was the first time in my life where I had that moment of, if you have an idea to do something and you go and talk to people about it and they come, you create a thing. So that was the very first moment, I think, where I thought, cool, maybe I can do that.
But later on though, I mean, you're still at school. Yep.
Yep.
You finished school?
Finished school.
Yeah, so yep. You finished school. Did you go on to do any tertiary education?
Yeah, or? I moved to Sydney, yep. Came to the Big Smoke.
Where were you from?
A little town called Sawtell, just south of Coffs Harbour.
Yeah, I know Sawtell.
Yeah.
I've been up there surfing. So you grew up in Sawtell, then you decided when you finished school, you go down to university, you move down to the Big Smoke.
Yep. Came to Sydney, went to UNSW, did a commerce degree.
Yep. Well, you must have done pretty well in HSC because it's hard to get a UNSW commerce degree in your era.
Yep.
It's not an easy course to get into.
My parents were school teachers. So
there you go. That works.
I had school at school and school at home.
Yeah, that works well. Works well. In terms of hitting the number, and you did a commerce degree.
Yep.
What's your major in?
I majored in marketing.
Marketing, yep. Yep. So what year was that?
I finished high school 2001. So yep. Then I finished uni 2004, right. I guess it was.
Okay,
2005
so.
Maybe.
Yeah, so you're in the Australian School of Business.
Mm-hmm.
Did you get a job after that?
Yeah, I went and got a job in an advertising agency because I thought that sounds like fun.
Old school agency.
Old school agency.
Compared to these days, yeah.
That's right.
Was it a big agency or like a boutique-y type?
It was a boutique agency. It was called Naked Communications.
Yep. I know these guys. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. It was kind of the hot shot agency for probably 5 years there.
Yeah, I actually think they did something for Wizard Naked.
They might have.
Yeah, they did. Yeah, 100%.
Matt
yeah.
Baxter.
I can't remember the names of the guys, but
Mike Wilson.
I remember the name, and I remember us, our marketing guy, head of marketing, actually told me about him, and they did a few ads for us on television.
Yeah. So it was an amazing little moment in time where they were. It was a global agency. It was kind of like 30 people, and they had 5 offices, I think. But it was just this melting pot of really smart, creative people, and being able to get in there as 23 or whatever I was, and just soak up a way of thinking about the world and understanding how you build brands and how you connect with people, how you build communities. It was super formative for me. Like I learned everything that I've put into business with all my businesses since then. I learned in that couple of years at that agency.
In terms of branding?
In terms of branding, in terms of building community, in terms of being entrepreneurial, in terms of having ideas and being bold enough to put them out into the world and then how to bring ideas to life. But I quickly learned, I was probably there for 3 or 4 years. I learned that I didn't really want to work in an advertising agency. I didn't really want to sell bottles of fizzy drink to people for the rest of my life.
Well, you didn't want to work for other people.
I didn't want to work for other people.
You didn't want to work for clients. Yeah.
Yeah. And so then I left.
I think it's important just to take a little pause here around this branding concept or the skill of branding. And you said something interesting, bringing things to life. This is during a period when there's no Instagram and
that's right.
Facebook might have just kicked off, might have been, but none of this sort of digital mediums and or digital social marketing. What did you learn that in terms of, say, building content around a brand?
Yeah, I worked in a team called Special Projects, which kind of straddled a whole bunch of different things. And we were really tasked with bringing to life what was at the time kind of non-traditional advertising ideas. So like you said, social media didn't exist then and it was kind of this little period where the world was coming out of big mainstream one-way media, you know, TV ads and billboards and starting to go into experiential marketing. So building event properties and then laddering into social media. So the team that I worked for was called Special Projects and it was everything that wasn't traditional media at the time. So I got a lot of experience in understanding new media at that time, right? Which was about how do you build an idea that lives in the world, that doesn't just live in a TV ad or a billboard that people can interact with, whether that's an event property or some kind of rallying campaign for a community, and then getting that idea out into the world through a whole bunch of different media channels and getting people to participate in that idea and talk about that idea and share it and getting it onto the front page of the Sydney Morning Herald.
Yeah, so the objective was to make this such a good idea or such an interesting idea or novel idea that someone in the mainstream media will pick it up and put it sort of in program, in other words, in the article.
That's right.
Front page of a Fin Review or front page of the Sydney Morning Herald, or they put it on a current affair because it's a new thing they saw, which is sort of quite effective when it comes to advertising and, or more importantly, marketing because it's not sort of paid ads.
That's right.
Because paid ads are sort of like, yeah, okay, I know what you're trying to do. You're trying to sell me something.
That's right. People smell them a mile away.
And they sort of work, don't get me wrong, but like
yep. It's
not as effective as in program. So you're in the middle of a current affair, discovers some client of yours because you've held some event, invited all the media there and they thought this is novel enough and this is good content for us. So it's about what's good content for them.
That's right.
And their audience.
That's right.
It's sort of interesting, which by the way is what sort of social media does today anyway, just as the platform's different. It's digital, that's the only difference. anyway, so during this period, you sort of cut your teeth on watching these creatives. I mean, did you just sort of sit there in a little room and, you know, bing, a bright idea is coming to your brain. Oh, yeah, I've done it. Or you're in the middle of the night, you wake up and you've got this great idea. How did you collaborate? How does that shit work?
It was that. And, like, I wasn't generally responsible for the ideas because I was just a young guy trying to work out how to do stuff, right? I was there in the room watching these super smart, strategic thinkers build these ideas, and then it was my job to go and implement that, execute that.
Okay, so opposed to this agency environment, why you left because you decided you want to do something for yourself, I guess.
Yeah. So there was a guy who had a little startup in the building that the agency was in downstairs, and he was working on an idea at the time.
How did you meet him?
Just in the lift, like just from being in the building. He was trying to build this surfing technology project. And I'm a surfer, so I think we obviously just gravitated to one another. I remember thinking, wow, that's a big idea. That's an awesome idea. I want to get involved in that. I want to do that thing.
So you're attracted to his idea?
Yeah, probably.
Yeah. Yep. And then people talk about networking. This is sort of the proper version of networking. You're attracted to an idea and you go for it.
Yep.
You sort of said, I'm going to talk to this guy.
Yep.
And do you build up a little bit of rapport? I mean, like, because a lot of people would be terrified to do that. A lot of people I know would never approach someone, even if they are attracted to the idea. Mm. One, they don't identify the fact they are attracted to the idea. They just think, oh, I wouldn't mind getting on further with this individual. But if they can articulate in their mind that I'm attracted to the idea, I think I can add some value to it.
Yep.
And it's a transaction. I'm going to actually go for it. I'm going to actually talk to the dude. Did you sort of think that? Did you articulate that at 23 or 24, however old you were?
I can't remember, to be honest. Yeah. What the process was there?
We're just one of these open. Open
I was just
people.
Like, I love this idea. I want to work on it.
Yeah, because you're just one of these open dudes who just, yeah, fuck you. Let's have a crack at it.
Yeah, yeah.
But a lot of people overthink these things.
Mm.
But, and I know lots of them are very bright, very talented, highly skilled, would be great assets. But they overthink everything. They think, oh, yeah, but maybe I'm going too far, or I shouldn't interfere, or maybe it's not my place. For those sort of people, as opposed to your style of person, by the way, your style of person is more rare. It's more likely people will overthink. What would you say to them in order just to get close to the dude that you got close to?
Yeah, look, I haven't thought about this for a long time, even like this interaction I'm thinking about with this guy, Andrew.
Not many people like that, okay?
Yeah.
But that, your personality gets you places because nothing's a problem and you'll get to meet the dude. Okay.
Yep.
And if the dude likes you, which he will because of your style of personality, then it's up to skills and all those other things that have to be employed.
One of the things I learned from that project, and we'll get to how that ended, but I've learned it multiple times in my life, is just have a crack. Like, what's the worst that can happen? The worst that can happen is it doesn't work.
Yeah, yeah.
And just whatever, go get another job or do something else.
Do you think that on reflection or you think that at the time?
I think I learned that from that first experience probably. I don't know if I was mature enough at the time to understand that. I was quite cocky when I was in my early 20s. I was full of confidence, and so yeah. I just thought, whatever, I can do that. I'll have a crack at it.
If I'm the same as you. I don't give a shit, whatever. I'll talk to anybody and do anything. And sometimes, by the way, it doesn't always work out.
It doesn't always work out.
It doesn't matter. You've got to have a start.
I think my thing is, if you have something that you want to achieve in your life, whatever that might be, you either go for it or you don't. Right. And if you're not willing to put yourself out there and have a crack at it, like, stop talking about it. The world's full of people that are going to do something. But there's very few people actually take the first step and go, I'm just going to start. Right. And you don't have to think about this big, lofty, grandiose endpoint. Yes, it's nice to have that, but don't worry about that. Just get started. Just do something today. Just do the first thing. Take the first step.
Take a breath and just do something today.
That's right.
And just, in other words, live in the present.
That's right.
Because a lot of these people, they overthink because they're planning. They're planning, well, then what happens? And then what happens? And who gives a fuck what happens after? Because you don't know.
You'll work it out when you get there.
It's like playing a game of chess. I can't, you know, at least some people may be able to, but I can't work out your next 10 moves.
Mm.
I can respond to your next move. I can maybe sort of out try and think that you might make a move after that, but I can't work out your 10 moves. So why do we do that in life? I mean, when we're trying to network or trying to get up in life when we identify something we really like or we are attracted to. So there's no point in trying to work out with that other, what the next 10 steps are going to be, because you never fucking work it out. Your best chance is to know how to respond to the next step. So put yourself in the position where you can do the next step. And that means talk to the dude.
Yep.
Or the person or the girl or whatever it is. You did that. Then what happened?
Yeah, so then the step for me was quit your job, right? And it was a relatively well-paying job for a 20-something-year-old guy. But I just trusted my gut. It was a great idea. I wanted to build something.
With the dude.
With the dude. So I quit my job and I came to work for him on his other business, his main business. And in the background, we were working together to try and build this idea.
And the main business was earning money so it could pay you something.
Correct.
Yeah, but it wasn't paying the same as you're getting out there.
It wasn't paying what I was paying.
So you took a hit.
I took a hit.
Yep.
But when you're young, like that stuff doesn't matter really, right? What's 20 grand, 30 grand, whatever, like when you're young. And then as we started to work together to build out this idea, it then got to the spot where we needed to put some money in. And so this was the first time that I'd put money into a business. At the time, I put my entire life savings in and I borrowed some money off my older sister who had some money as well and put a chunk of money into my first ever project, which at the time was crazy scary, I'm sure. But in hindsight, it taught me a massive lesson, which is if you want to go after something, put all the chips into the middle of the table because then you've got to make it work, right? So then I stopped working for him, stopped taking a wage and just I had some money left over to live off and the rest went into this startup and we went and did it. Basically, it was a surfing technology project. It's kind of a similar to Fitbit, a decade before Fitbit became a thing. It was a piece of wearable technology designed for surfers. You connected it to your boardies or your wetsuit and it tracked all of your activity in the water. So it told you how many waves you caught, how fast each wave was, how long each wave was, and then mapped that data over Google Maps. This was in 2005 or 6, so very rudimentary technology to what we have today. We went to Taiwan, we found a chip manufacturer who could build this thing for us, which was a crazy experience for me to get on a plane and go to Taiwan and go visit a chip manufacturer. And then we started pitching to the big global surf brands, to Billabong, to Quiksilver, to Rip Curl. And they started flying us around the world, got flown out to Huntington Beach, got flown to Hawaii, spent Pipeline Masters at the Billabong house right on Pipeline, hanging out with all my surfing idols as a kid. It was a crazy, crazy experience. And we ended up getting into a bidding war between Quiksilver and Billabong for this technology, for the rights to it globally. And we ended up doing a deal with Billabong, who essentially acquired the rights to the technology. And then the GFC happened, right? And Billabong and Quiksilver and all the big surf brands went into a tailspin. Lots of people lost their jobs. All the senior global executive team that were working on this project were made redundant. So the project actually never went to market. We did a soft launch at the Pipeline Masters one year with a bunch of surfers wearing it in the event broadcast live. But then it got shelved and put in a cupboard somewhere at Billabong and has never seen the light of day. So this trajectory was super rapid. It was like a 6-month project from putting my life savings on the line to being in global board meetings with multi-billion dollar businesses bidding on this thing to it not existing anymore.
So when we hit financial crises, whether it be a recession or whatever it is, capital expenditure, just the first thing you get canned is capital expenditure.
Yeah.
But the second thing you get canned is all the growth people. So anyone in the organization who chases growth, you know, CEOs, general managers, whatever, they all get asked. And they get replaced by CFOs, chief financial officers, who are there to tighten the joint up. And the game is spend no money, maintain all cash flow, nothing goes out the door. All capital projects that are going to help us grow, forget it. And what we're just going to do is just going to be business as usual, that is selling wetsuits or whatever it is and just
batten down the hatches,
trim the sails, see what happens.
Yep.
And we'll go again when it all opens up again. That's the general process when we get recessions or GFCs, which, by the way, we get one every 8 or 10 years. So, or something happens one every 8 or 10 years. And that's exactly what will happen in the next round, which will be in 3 or 4 years from now.
Yep.
For sure. And who knows what caused it? Who gives a shit? We don't have to know. But we will get one in 3 or 4 years' time. So you dusted your dough.
I got my money back because of the
rights action.
They paid some money to acquire it, to take it off the table for everyone else. So we got our money back. Had a heck of an experience.
Yeah, but a good experience, though.
Amazing. Learned so much stuff.
Yeah, yeah. Because they're massive brands. They're big brands. You got exposure to big brand guys.
Yeah, yeah.
And at the execution level too.
Yep. And, it was amazing.
Yeah, and being flying around the place, that's always pretty good. Because I often wondered, I mean, I know the effect it has on me, but what do you think global travel does when you go to Taiwan, you meet the Taiwanese chip makers, or you go to Huntington Beach and you meet the, you know, Rip Curl, O'Neill, or whoever is you're meeting there? What is the net effect when you think back about it, like in terms of hindsight? What do you get out of it?
That specific experience, I think, taught me that. It reinforced what I thought at the start, which is just have a crack at it. What's the worst that can happen? And this is how things, this is how big projects happen in the world. It's how big companies get scaled up, is someone just says, I'm just going to give it a crack, and you go and do it, right? That was a learning for me. You just get on a plane, you go to Taiwan and you meet a manufacturer, and that's how you set up a supply chain.
Have you ever reflected on the thought or the feeling, most importantly, the feeling you got from that experience?
It was amazing.
Yeah.
I felt like a rock star.
Yeah.
Like, I really did.
Do you feel motivated?
I was super motivated.
And inspired?
I did. It was massively inspiring.
Because I think that's one of the big issues right now with global no travel.
Yep.
Is we start to lack inspiration and motivation, to me.
Because, yeah,
totally. New ideas. Because you go into this place, you go, wow, look how this city works. Look how these people operate. Look what they can do. Wow, how cool is a factory? You know, you get a surprise when you get these factories. They're like massive factories. Everyone's walking around with white masks and white suits on, stuff like that. And you go, oh, this is a new world. I never experienced this, especially a kid coming from the Central Coast.
Yep.
You know, all of a sudden, you know, it's one thing to move Sydney to Big Smoke. My God, you're in Taiwan.
Yeah, totally.
You know, the chip making capital of the world.
Yep.
You know, like the best technology in the world, or you're at Huntington or a pipeline.
Yeah.
Like, what the fuck? I mean, in terms of that industry,
yeah,
that's like Mecca.
Yeah, it is.
And you get inspired.
You do. It was amazing. And you're right, like seeing new stuff, being exposed to new ideas, new stimulus, it does. It motivates you, it inspires you.
Travel for me is I do it to clear my head and to be inspired. So I won't go on holiday and go and hang out and on Honolulu Beach just to have a rest. You know, I'm not, fuck that. Like, you can have a rest anywhere. I'll go to a place where I'm going to do something new. Like, you might go to Tokyo, or you might go to wherever. You go to somewhere where you're going to learn something and,
yep,
get something out of it.
Yep.
And something that's, you get exposed to something that you've never been exposed to. I think it's a good way to travel. That's cool. So didn't work, got inspired, motivated, great experience, didn't dust your money, got your money back at least. What happened then?
Got brutalized. Right, because it's a failure.
Yeah.
At the end of the day.
Yeah.
That took me a bit of time to dust myself off. Probably 6 months.
Yep.
Kind of wandered around Sydney.
So you felt a bit smacked about.
Thinking, what am I going to do? I'm a failure.
What happened to your mate? What happened to your mate, your business partner?
So there was three of us.
Yeah.
One of them had just sold a tech company, so he'd built all the technology. So he was kind of good because he'd made some cash. And the other guy, I think, went back to his other business that he had.
Right, no real feelings though, all good.
Yeah, like it was one of those things of life.
Yeah.
That stuff happens.
So you're wandering around aimlessly in Sydney, thinking of what the fuck.
Thinking about what I'm going to do. And one of my best mates at the time who I'd met.
Is this in 2008, 2009?
Yeah, this would have been about then, I guess. Yep. One of my best mates at the time who I'd met at the agency that I'd come from before, he and I had been talking about wanting to start something, a business built around, you know, a really strong brand proposition. And so we started thinking about just what categories you could go into and disrupt and build a really interesting brand. And then one night we were out for dinner and we walked into a bottle shop to get a bottle of wine for dinner. And we had one of those aha moments where we looked at a big wall of wine in a bottle shop. And this was a decade ago. And the category was just the same. Every single wine brand was talking about the same stuff. It was about awards. It was about heritage. It was about provenance. There was nothing interesting or exciting going on in the wine world. And as young guys who wanted to drink some wine, nothing spoke to us. So we said, let's start a wine brand of all things, right? And so then we just went and did that. And I put all the money that had gone into the first project that I got back, went into this next thing. So again, just pushed all the chips to the middle of the table and started a wine brand called Cake Wines. And I spent 6 years building that business. And the whole premise of the company was to try and introduce a whole new generation of people to wine, take out some of the snobbiness, some of the wankery that lives in traditional wine world, and make it more inviting and inclusive for a new generation of wine drinkers. So we did a lot of stuff around bringing wine and culture together. So we would do rooftop parties here in Sydney. We'd do laneway parties. We'd do art exhibitions. We'd do...
Sort of similar to what you're doing when you're with the agency.
Exact same thinking.
Event style. And exact same thinking. Did you get picked up publicity-wise?
We got heaps of publicity.
Yeah.
We scaled that business pretty quickly.
Was it a white label? I mean, did you get someone else to make the wine and you just...
Yeah, so we had a winemaking team in the Adelaide Hills.
Yep.
So we had contracts with growers. So we were purchasing fruit from growers in the Adelaide Hills and McLaren Vale. We had a contract winemaking facility, and then we had our own winemaker who worked for us, made the wines.
Yep. So you actually produced the wine yourself.
We were producing wines.
Yep.
And we had a national distribution team. We actually had a cellar door here in Redfern for a couple of years. It was an awesome, fun, amazing business, but also a young man's game, kind of doing events and running hospitality venues and traveling around the country slinging wine.
Yeah. It's a heavy sort of hand-to-hand combat with, the pub owners and the bar owners and the restaurant owners and blah, blah, blah.
And the big brands.
And the big brands, all of whom own most of the liquor stores too. So you're trying to get shelf space and you want to get in a shelf space where people can see you.
It's a tough game.
Yeah, totally.
The booze game in general, like no matter what category of booze you're in, booze is hard work.
Yeah, bloody oath. So what happened at the end of this business?
I learned a lot in that business though, because I learned how to be a door-to-door salesman.
Yeah, well, that's what you're going to be, is hand-to-hand combat.
That's something I'd never done before.
I call that hand-to-hand combat because it actually is. Everybody wrestles differently. Every single place you go to, door-to-door, to try and get on their shelf or whatever it is at the back of the shelf, they're different personalities and you just got to wrestle them differently. They're all got different sort of loves and hates, and you're trying to actually assess people there and then on the spot. Did you do that yourself?
Yeah, that was me. Yeah. I spent probably 4 years out of that 6 years being a salesman. Like, and there's nothing more unglamorous than going into a shitty little mum and dad bottle shop out the back of nowhere.
You think, oh, the fuck are we going
to
do?
That you're going to sell 6 bottles of wine to?
Yeah, what are these guys going to be like? Are they going to fuck me around? Are they going to be nice? Are they going to be unnice? How am I feeling today?
That's right.
Get up, have a coffee. Fuck. Staying in a motel.
Yep.
Some shit motel somewhere.
Yep.
Yeah, I can see it.
And you're eating shit food.
Renting a car.
That's right. Everything on the string of the smell of an oily rag.
You're stopping at a service station, you're buying a Kit Kat and a bag of chips, that's your lunch.
Yep.
And you're trying to drink water, but you think, fuck that, I'll drink something else.
Oh,
kombucha wasn't around then either. So
flashbacks, Mark. Yeah, flashbacks.
Yeah. But it's actually good grounding. It's hard-nosed hustle.
It's amazing. I would recommend to anyone, if you want to be an entrepreneur, go get a job in the sales gear. Learn how to do that.
Take a job selling hair clips in chemists out in the bush.
That's right.
Get them to put your hair clip brand up.
Yep.
The little rack that you put in. Like, imagine some of those people, I really take my hat off to them, but it is a great way to learn the hustle.
It is.
I fucking love it. Yep. What happened to that business? Sell it?
So my business partner, who was one of my best mates at the time, we ended up having a falling out. Which is a massive regret in my life. Don't go into business with your best mates.
Yep.
Not worth it. And I got to the point where I just wanted to get out. So I ended up selling my share of the business to him and another investor. And I left that business in 2017.
Right.
Packed up my life, put some money in the bank, finally, after back-to-back 2 startup.
Yep.
I was with my now wife. She came through that 6-year journey. And at the end, I convinced her to pack up our lives and go on a crazy once-in-a-lifetime trip to the most remote parts of the world we could get to. And we essentially lived in a tent for the better part of 18 months. And that is where I came up with this idea for Zeroco.
Where'd you go?
We went to some crazy places. We trekked along the border of Tajikistan and Afghanistan for about a month.
Was it dangerous shit?
There were some moments that were pretty dangerous, in hindsight. I never felt unsafe. Spent a month in Iran, spent a lot of time in Kurdish villages right on the border with Iraq, which was quite an interesting thing. I went to North Korea, which
How the fuck did you get in there? can you get North Korea?
You can go to North Korea.
I didn't know that.
You can. You have to go on a government sanctioned tour.
Right.
So you only get to see what they want you to see.
They hold your hand.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. But you can go to North Korea.
What did you see there? I've got no idea about the joint.
Yeah, yeah. It was the craziest place I've ever been in my life. And you just can't comprehend what it's like until you go there. Every single moment that you are there is curated, and some really weird stuff happens that you can't even begin to fathom why they curated that. So one of the crazy experiences, or just like a little throwaway thing that we saw every day, there's an island in a lake in the middle of Pyongyang, the capital, where the tourists go to stay, so you can't get away at night.
You can't escape.
And there's a bridge that goes out to the island, and there's a strip of grass probably a meter wide on either side of the road. And every morning there were ladies with scissors cutting the grass with scissors.
You're joking.
As the bus would drive past. And so you just think, what the fuck is that about?
Totally.
Like, why do they think to do that? What are they trying to? They've done that for a reason. What's the point of that thing? So there were just moments like that every day of complete weirdness.
Yeah, it's random.
Completely random, unrational. You just can't even try to work out what they were doing.
Well, what are some of the things that stick in your mind apart from that one?
One of the amazing things was that people everywhere were lovely to us. There was only probably one or two times that we felt unsafe in the entire trip. One of those was crossing over the border from Iran into Armenia. That was a pretty dodgy border crossing. There were some pretty dodgy characters. But outside of little pockets of that, people were overwhelmingly hospitable to us, and places where you don't expect people to be hospitable because what you see in the mainstream media were the most. Like, Iranians are the friendliest people on the planet. I've never experienced hospitality like I have in Iran. I've been to 50-something countries now, and they are on a whole nother level of hospitality. We hardly paid for anything for the month we were in the country. People would come up to us in the street and in broken English say, "You're coming to stay at my house tonight." And they would force you to go and stay at their house, and they'd give up their bed and they'd feed you. And then the next day you'd tell them, "Oh, we're going to the next city, Shiraz. Oh, my cousin's uncle's sister lives there. She'll come and meet you." And then they put you up at their house. The Iranians are an incredible,
unbelievably hospitable
culture of people. Amazing.
That's cool. And can I, out of that 18-month experience, what motivated you to start up ZeroCo?
Yeah, so I had a hunch that on this trip I'd probably have a moment of clarity or inspiration or whatever, and I'd come up with an idea. But I didn't know what it was, and I wasn't going there specifically for that outcome. I just wanted to get out into wilderness and have an amazing time trekking to some of the most remote places I could get to and push my comfort zone into, you know, places I get me outside my comfort zone, basically. And one of the things that I started to really realize was how much plastic waste there is.
It's scary, isn't it?
Super scary. And like, when you go to big population centers, you go to China, you go to India, you go to Indonesia, you expect to see plastic, and you do see plastic because there's 100 million people living on top of one another with no waste infrastructure.
Yep.
But when you go out into proper wilderness and you're walking for weeks at a time without seeing other humans and you see stuff, it really started to get to me. The place that it got to me the most was we went to Kamchatka, which is a peninsula in the far northeast of Russia up near Alaska. You can't get there by land from Russia. It's completely cut off. It's the world's most volcanic region. There's more volcanoes on this peninsula than anywhere else on the planet. There's no roads. There's no infrastructure. You have to get around in these big old ex-Soviet military trucks called Kamazes. They're like eight-wheel trucks with wheels this high. Because you literally, as soon as you get out of the city that you fly into, there's no roads. So you are driving literally across glaciers and across volcanic fields and along beaches. And there was this section of that trip where we spent 2 days just driving along this deserted beach in the middle of nowhere. And the beach was just covered in plastic.
That's weird, eh?
It was crazy.
And you don't see, no one's swimming or surfing or no boats or ships.
No one even lives there.
Yeah.
There's no humans around. And so I just really started to think about
that the messes scale. Your head up a bit, doesn't it?
Massively. It massively messed with my head because there shouldn't be plastic in these places because there's no people. So I basically spent probably the last 6 months of this trip just walking around the wilderness thinking very deeply about plastic and the problem and what a potential solution could be. And anytime I got into internet range, I would be downloading papers and just trying to read as much as I could and get my head around the problem and what people are doing out there in the world at the moment. And it was really fortuitous, to be honest with you, because usually when you are thinking about a business idea, I don't know, in my previous experiences, I never had a 6 month block with nothing else to distract me, just to think really, really deeply about a problem, which is what I did. So when I came back to Australia, I had a really well thought out, well articulated strategy for what I was going to do, which enabled me to do it quickly and scale it quite quickly.
That's probably a good place was to jump off in the second part, why don't we go to the break? We'll come straight back and we'll talk about Zero.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Coming back from the break, we're here with Mike Smith from Zeroca, the founder of Zeroca. We've just gone through his journey. I mean, his amazing journey that he had, particularly, I mean, I love that 18-month sabbatical, which turned into a business idea. You know, of all things, it's, you know, through observation. It's amazing when you have a time to breathe when you're on a holiday or you're on a trek like you were in your case, and you've got nothing else to do but breathe. You know, there's nothing to do except think and breathe.
Yep.
And then you get confronted by a problem and you start to think and breathe and concentrate on the problem. You've come up with this idea about plastic. How did you come up with a solution and what is the solution?
Yeah, so I kind of thought about it at a kind of macro level to begin with. I was kind of category agnostic when I was thinking about how I was going to solve this problem. And it really ladded off kind of two insights, right? Which is to solve the plastic problem globally, there's two things we have to do. First of all, we need to stop using single-use plastic. We need to stop making more plastic and putting it into the world, using it, buying it from the supermarket, using it for a couple of weeks and chucking it in the bin. We've got to stop doing that, because as long as there's more plastic coming in, we're just going to be, the mountain of plastic is going to get bigger and bigger and bigger.
It's fucking dumb when you think about it. Like,
it's so dumb.
It's just, like, we're the problem, consumers, and to be honest with you, part of it, because we allow this to happen. We sponsor it. You know, I'm one of them. I mean, more recently, I've become really conscious of it. But I just don't understand why people give you, for example, like I might go to the gym, get a protein shake, and they give it to me in a plastic cup, a big plastic cup, and then they don't recycle the plastic cup. I walk out with it, then I just fucking throw it away.
Yep.
And I thought to myself, well, I take it home, wash it, and bring it back to make a point, but I don't. And now I don't buy the protein shake because. And I said, why don't you just get a paper cup or something?
Mm.
Or give all of us a, you know, like a container or something, and we just keep it, I'll keep it in my bag, I'll give it to you to fill it up.
Yep.
But I haven't quite got to that point myself of actually forcing the issue.
Mm.
And I could easily do it. I just don't understand it. Do people not think about this shit? Or what is it? What is it, laziness? What is it?
It's convenience.
Yeah, but what? Yeah, but that's sort of like lazy convenience.
And look, I think
it's inconvenient from my point of view.
It is. And look, it's partly us as people, but it's also partly companies, right?
Yeah, no, the vendor is a problem. So I was watching a show last night, knowing that you were coming on today, and it was about this issue. I seem to recall that 70% of all single-use plastics are produced by 20 companies in the world.
Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah.
And Australia is one of the worst.
Worst per capita.
One of the worst, yeah.
Number one in the world.
Yeah.
Per capita.
Unbelievable. I got a shock. I went Australia, UK and US.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I went, what the fuck?
59 kilos of single-use plastic per person in Australia.
That's ridiculous.
It's pretty crazy. It's really crazy.
Yeah. Sorry, go on.
So job number one, stop using single-use plastic. We've got to work out a way to do that. And then job number two is we've got to work out a way to deal with all of the plastic that's made its way into the natural environment and get it out of there, right? Job number one's relatively easy, and we'll get to that, how to solve problem number one. Problem number two is difficult because plastic.
Well, job number one's about behaviour change.
And supply chain change.
Well, and change the behaviour of the suppliers. So, yep. But they're going to say it every time I sell, every time there's a single-use plastic, I get paid for the next one. So I get, it's in their interest, isn't it?
Yeah.
To sell 10,000 instead of selling one that gets used 10,000 times.
That's right. That's right. So, but when I first started thinking about the first problem of, okay, how do you stop single-use plastic? I just straight away thought back to the milkman, right? We had this model not that long ago, a generation ago.
I was one of them. I used to collect the bottles, the empty bottles.
Yep.
And
milkman,
the money.
Milkman would come to your door,
yeah.
Drop off some bottles.
Yeah.
The next day he'd come back and pick up the empty ones,
yeah.
Take them back to the dairy,
yeah.
Clean them,
yeah.
And refill them.
That was me. I did the job. And yeah. I'll go one step further with it. We didn't even have a car. We had a horse. Had a big draft horse. His name was Sam. And Sam, I used to do it at, I was at school, but I used to do it at, I used to start at midnight. And Sam, I have a really clear vision, right? The bloke I worked for, his name was Lindsay. He was my next door neighbour. And I was a kid. He was an older guy. And I used to go and help him on weekends and Friday nights and Saturdays sometimes. But Friday nights, Saturdays used to collect the money, but Friday nights was the delivery. We used to get this draft horse. And Sam, I have this vision or memory of the draft in the middle of winter, pitch black. We used to do around Bexley. And Lindsay used to stop at this house and he used to go and have a few whiskeys. I was a kid, so wasn't allowed. And I used to have to see there was Sam, the horse, just waiting for Lindsay to come out. Sam knew exactly what house to stop at, where he knew the horse knew every house where to stop. So we didn't always deliver milk at every house.
Yep.
He'd stop every second or third house. He knew exactly the route. And when we were outside this house that we used to stop off and Lindsay used to go and have a few whiskeys with his mate, and I used to sit there in the freezing fucking cold. I have a clear memory of Sam, the horse, draft horse, just me and him, pitch black, middle of the night, no fucking people around. And I used to see steam coming out of the draft horse's nostrils. I remember so clearly in the middle of winter. And I used to sit there freezing to fucking death and thinking, how long is Lindsay going to be? And once he invited me in and he said, would you like one of these? I said, no thanks. Like, I didn't even know whiskey. I never had whiskey. I was like 15 or something. I don't know. Like, whiskey was a bit foreign to me. A beer, I might have had a beer, but not whiskey. And and we used to do that. We used to collect the bottles. I used to go run down the side there, and there was always a fucking cat or a dog there. Or I used to think there was that or a spider web. I used to have to put my hand around the side to get the money. No credit cards, there was money laying around there.
Yep.
And the money was in a little hidey hole. Every house had a little hidey spot. And I used to pick there was a crate. We used to have like a sort of a steel crate with plastic coating around the crate. And then there was for six bottles, and the bottles were a pint each.
Yep.
And you pick that, you'd get the empty one up and you take one in full and you replace the full one with the empty one, take it back in.
That's right.
That was cool.
Trip down memory lane there.
Yeah.
Back in the good old days.
Yeah. But that worked.
It worked, right? So when I first started thinking about the first problem, stopping single-use plastic, I just thought, we've already worked it out.
Single-use bottles.
It's been done before.
Yeah.
We just got to build a machine to clean stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? So that was... in my mind, really easy. We'll get to that.
Or build bottles that can be cleaned.
That's right.
Yeah.
Or both.
Yeah.
The second part, which is working out how do you get plastic out of the ocean at scale.
That's a big deal.
Is challenging because it's no individual government's responsibility. Like the plastic that's out in international waters, who's going to fund to get that cleaned up? Charities don't have the scale to do that. So my approach was, the only way that's ever going to get done is if you can build a market-based mechanism where you can monetize the collection of plastic and give it productive use. So I came back to Australia and said, that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to build a business that does those two things, that stops single-use plastic and funds large-scale ocean cleanups. Came back to Australia with that as the economic model I was going to explore, and I was agnostic about what product I was going to do that with. Then I went and started spending a very uncomfortable amount of time in supermarkets, following people around, watching how they were shopping, being a creep a little bit, to be honest with you.
It was market research.
Market research. And I found myself spending more and more time in the last three aisles of the supermarket, which is where the cleaning and personal care stuff lives. Shampoo, body wash, hand wash, laundry liquid, dishwashing detergent. Those three aisles are floor to ceiling, wall to wall, single use plastic, right? And that's when I started thinking, okay, there's something here because it's a big, massive category and it's pretty unsexy, right? And I'd learned from my last business, Cake Wines, about going in and disrupting a big, boring industry that has had no innovation for a decade or more. And that's what home cleaning and personal care has been for 50 years, right? Omo has been Omo since my grandmother used Omo. It hasn't changed.
The Earth brand sort of tried to change it up a little bit.
They've tried to do some stuff.
It looks a bit better.
A little bit better?
I feel better, but it's still single use.
Still single use.
Yeah.
So then I said, okay, great. I'm going to go and launch a personal care and home cleaning company that's going to make amazing planet-friendly products that you use every day in your house. And I'm going to work out a way to deliver it direct to Aussie homes, minus all the single-use plastic, in packaging that is made from plastic pulled out of the ocean.
And you made the ingredients as well. You made the stuff that goes inside.
We've got a contract manufacturer.
Yeah, yeah.
So we basically the journey was once we had the idea, we said, okay, let's go and do this. I knew this was going to be a pretty capital intensive business to get off the ground. So we went and did a Kickstarter campaign. I'd never run a Kickstarter campaign before, complete novice at it. But I just believed that the time was right for an idea like this. And I talked to lots and lots of people about this from all walks of life, like from my grandmother to mates of mine in Sydney, right? And everybody said the same thing, which is it is silly how much plastic we put in our bin every week at home. I'd be open to a solution. So we built a shitty little landing page that I built myself for $200, and we started running some Facebook ads, driving traffic to the website, basically saying, hey, I've got this idea. I don't know how I'm going to do it just yet, but are you interested? And we had like 15,000 Aussies sign up to our mailing list in about a month. It was really overwhelming, and it just gave me a heap of confidence right at the start of the project that there was a market out there for this and people wanted to be part of the solution. So then we said, okay, let's go and do a Kickstarter campaign to try and raise some money to help us fund this thing. I'd put my life savings back in at this point again. So it was the third time I'd pushed all the chips back into the middle of the table. And I had a goal to try and raise $250,000. And we did that in about a day and a half. And we went on to raise $750,000.
Wow.
Which I believe, at least at the time, it was the most funded Kickstarter project in Australian history, selling only to Australians. There were some people who'd raised more money doing stuff globally.
I think Flowhive.
Flowhive did more. Yeah. But this was
a long time before you, though.
That's right.
Yeah.
This was the biggest one only selling to Australians. Mm. We had 7,500 Aussies say, yeah, I'm in, let's do this, which was amazing, right? It was so amazing. And it was people from all walks of life. It was 70-year-olds from Ballarat. It was inner city hipsters from Redfern. It was hippies from Byron Bay. It was tradies from Perth. It was everyone. We sold product to all demographics in all markets around Australia. Which just was a second burst of confidence and shot in the arm that we're onto something here. So that gave us some money to go and get the business started. So we hired some industrial chemists. We started formulating all of our products. And the brief to the formulators was, we need to make products that perform as well, if not better, than the big market-leading brands that you get.
You're talking about the stuff inside the...
Stuff inside?
Yeah, yeah.
And we need to do that at a price that's comparable to the market leader. So for example, Dynamo Professional is rated the number one laundry liquid in Australia at the supermarket by the Choice website. So we got bottles of Dynamo and we sent it to our formulators and we said, you got to beat that without using any nasty ingredients. So there's no palm oil, there's no petrochemicals, there's no SLS, SLES. They're all plant-based formulas. We said, we want you to make a really good laundry liquid, for example, using really good natural ingredients. And we didn't say you're done, the job is done, until we could beat or match the market leading brand. So we sent all of our formulas off to independent laboratories and we had to do iteration after iteration after iteration until we could match the best brands. So then we knew we had a really awesome product. It was then time to build the supply chain. And me in my youthful naivety thought this would be super easy, right? to make a reusable pouch and a reusable bottle.
Did you have in your mind the pouch and the bottle? Did you know what you want to look like, or how'd you work that out?
This is a body wash bottle. How do you ship something from our factory to a customer, get them to use it, then ship it back in the most environmentally friendly way and the most cost efficient way?
Ship back when they're finished with it.
That's right. Yeah. So the original model was we'll ship you this full, you'll use it, you'll ship it back to us. But that means shipping a big empty bottle. And if you've got 10 of these, it's a
volume.
Yeah. It's a big carbon footprint. It's a lot of cost. So then I started thinking about, okay, how can we ship something to a customer that's big when it's full and then flat packed when it comes back? It's kind of the reverse IKEA model, right? So then we started exploring pouches, right? Which serve that purpose. It's full when it's big when it's full. When it's empty, it's flat. So then we took it one step further and said, we don't want to make pouches out of new plastic, even if they're getting shipped back and forth and refilled over and over and over again. What if we could make this out of recycled plastic to begin with? So then we went down a gigantic rabbit hole of trying to work out how to make a pouch from recycled material. No one had ever done it anywhere in the world. We spoke to hundreds and hundreds of suppliers. We finally found an Australian company who agreed to work with us on this. It took us months and months and months of testing. And what we've been able to do is build a pouch that's at the moment made from 50% recycled plastic. First time it's ever been done in the world. So the way the business model works is, so this is a 1 liter bottle of pouch and multi-purpose cleaner, 500 ml multi-purpose cleaner bottle. When you sign up to Xeroco, in your first box, you get a set of what we call forever bottles. These are made from plastic we've pulled out of the ocean. You keep this at your house and you fill it up with this.
Right.
You then send this back to us in a postage paid return envelope. We then clean and sanitize this pouch, fill it up, send it out again. So that's how the model solves both problems. This stops single-use plastic and this funds large-scale ocean cleanups.
Right.
So we went down a huge rabbit hole to build a pouch from recycled material.
So does every one of the containers have a pouch?
Every one of the containers has its own pouch.
Right.
Yep.
And you can buy as many pouches as you want too.
You can buy one, you can buy 10, you can buy whatever you want.
Yep.
We send you a postage paid return envelope. So it doesn't. We cover the cost of shipping back to us and then we clean them and send them back out again.
How's it work in terms of pricing, costing and margins and stuff like that?
So it is cost comparable with what you'd pay at the supermarket.
To buy, say, but that's multi-purpose.
Multi-purpose cleaner. Our hand wash costs the same as, thank you.
Right.
Okay. Our laundry liquid costs the same as Dynamo.
Right.
It's all basically
when you say you sell it to me for the same price.
Same price.
And in terms of your costs, sir, and your margin.
Yeah, so the thing that we've been able to do is because we've gone direct to the customer, we've cut out
30%.
Distributor.
So and there's at least 30% cost. Yeah, okay.
There's extra money in our pocket to enable us to fund.
So if you're doing it through, I don't know, one of the big Woolworths or IGA or something like that, you've got to pay them the marketing cost, the shelf cost.
They want 50% margin.
50%, yeah, okay. Yeah. So which means you're saving 50%, okay, because you're doing all direct.
That's right.
Yeah.
Direct.
Okay, that's cool.
Direct
that's
to cool. customer.
So you've got, I can see the pink one there. And
yeah, so we've got dishwashing liquid. There's 10 products in the range.
Yep.
So the idea was from day one, we want to have as many products as possible to make it as convenient for a family to sign up,
yep.
get as much of your stuff from us.
And how do you engage them as the families, whoever it is, as a community? I mean, what are you doing in terms of community engagement? Because it's one thing for them to transact with you, get it?
Yep.
What about community engagement though? How do you bring them on the journey along with the story and all that sort
yeah,
of stuff?
Yeah, totally. So look, one of the things that we've spent a lot of time focusing on is taking people on the journey of building this business. So everything has been documented. There's been so many blogs written and videos and emails out to our customers at every single stage of this journey explaining exactly what we are doing. And people have really resonated with that. We've got 30,000 customers that we've signed up in 6 months now.
So you've only been going for not even 6 months, six months.
We officially launched in November of last year. We started shipping products. Right. Yeah. We've shipped over 300,000 pouches out to 30,000 homes now.
That's fantastic.
Which is amazing. And we've been blown away by the growth of this thing and the support that we are getting. And back to the community engagement thing, one of the things we've really done a lot of effort on is taking people on the journey around the ocean cleanup stuff that we've been doing. So straight after our Kickstarter campaign, we jumped on a plane. This was pre-COVID. We went to Indonesia and we pulled 500,000 water bottles worth of plastic out of the Java Sea. We recycled that plastic and we turned them into our first generation forever bottles.
How the fuck do you do that? Like, I mean, you hire a ship or something. What do you do?
So we partnered with a company that does ocean cleanup. So one of the good things about the problem with ocean waste now is there's lots of not-for-profits and lots of companies around the world that are doing cleanup projects now. So we were able to tap into an existing supply chain. And we documented this entire process. And I was going there to see for myself, what does this process look like?
So what are we doing? Like a barge or something?
We're talking about fishermen in rickety little boats that fish in the morning and in the afternoon go out and collect plastic.
Oh, wow.
So we got on these rickety boats with these Indonesian fishermen and we went out and we just saw kilometres and kilometres and kilometres of rubbish.
I don't know if that's up on your pages, on your social media, but like I have to say, like I have experienced this. And I was in Malaysia but not far from Thailand. So I was on the Malaysian coast looking at Thailand, the bottom of Thailand. And I was staying on an island there and I was staying at a really swanky sort of hotel, which had a beachfront. The next door was like nothing. It was just vacant. And on the other side was vacant. You walk out of the hotel and you walk down the beach. Beautiful, nice, clean beach. Beautiful and clean. You walk to the edge of where the
I know where this story goes.
Where the premises stop, where their border is, whatever you call it. Where their border is. Not their border, their the edge
the
of
property boundary.
Property boundary. And it's fucking like, I'm serious. I'm not joking. It would have been 3 foot, nearly a meter high and maybe 6-7 meters deep on the shoreline of plastic bottles and shit, plastic shit. There's just fucking piles of it.
Yep.
And what this particular hotel did is they would walk around and clean up their thing every day. They'd get, before I got up, there'd be 20, 30 people there just getting rid of all this shit.
Yep.
And they told me, and I killed me, and I really ruined my whole day, to be honest, seeing all this. But they said to me it all floats down from Thailand on the tide. Like, because people, they're blaming Thailand, of course. But they said to me that people just dump their fucking plastic there and it all goes into the sea.
Yep.
And it all just comes across in the tide.
Yep.
You can see Thailand from this particular place. So I thought, what the fuck? This must be all through Asia.
It's crazy. A garbage truck of plastic goes into the ocean every minute worldwide. 21 million tons a year. It's projected to get to.
What do they think? They must be off their head. But don't they understand what they're doing?
Well, this is one of the things I've learned on this project in the year and a half I've been working on it. It's not just overseas. We think we've solved the problem in Australia. We have not solved the problem at all. Less than 15% of the plastic you put in your yellow bin at home gets recycled. 85% of the plastic that we all think is being recycled in Australia by putting it in the yellow bin goes to landfill.
At least it goes to land. It doesn't get thrown in the fucking beach.
So that's again what you think, right? That's what I thought. So we, over the last 6 months, we've been working on a project to bring our ocean cleanups home to Australia, because we've gone up to the Great Barrier Reef and we've seen the problem up there. Gets even worse the further north you get. And so we've been planning out a bunch of ocean cleanups in Australia. We did our first one 2 weeks ago. We set a world record by doing the world's longest solo underwater ocean cleanup. We had one of our customers, a mate of ours, Dean Kropp, was in a scuba outfit on the bottom of Sydney Harbour for 24 hours straight, and he pulled 200 kilos of waste off the bottom of Sydney Harbour.
Wow.
One guy in 24 hours, just by himself, off the bottom of Sydney Harbour. So we still have a massive problem in Australia. It's not as big as some parts of Asia where they don't have at least garbage trucks that come and get it and take it and put it in a hole in the ground. But we've got a massive problem here in Australia as well.
Yeah.
So now we're doing all our ocean cleanups in Australia. We're taking plastic out of Sydney Harbour. We're about to do another one on Fraser Island. We've taken some stuff off the Great Barrier Reef, processing that in Australia and turning it into our second generation Forever bottles, which we're making in Australia now.
That'll be pretty cool too. I mean, it looks like a duck actually. It's just in terms of the design.
Yep.
Just in terms of the design.
Yes.
How did you go about these things?
So one of the things from day one that I said to myself is, if we're going to have a scalable impact on this plastic problem, this needs to be a mainstream proposition. So you have to have amazing products that work as well as the supermarket. It needs to be the same price as the supermarket, and it has to look amazing, right? Because I want this hand body wash bottle to live at your place forever. Mm. I want your kids to inherit it from you, right? My parents have got a beetroot container, a Tupperware beetroot container that's been in my fridge, my parents' fridge, since I was a kid. And when my parents pass away, my sister and I will have a debate about who inherits the beetroot Tupperware container, right? I want these things to be the same generational objects that have emotional connection to them that you pass on to your children.
Where do you think you can go with this? So okay, I get this is great. I love this.
Yep.
So what's your next iteration?
So we've got, there's 10 products in the range right now. We're about to launch four or five new products. So we'll be releasing a shampoo, a conditioner, a deodorant, a toothpaste, and potentially a mouthwash in the months ahead. And then we will continue to iterate out into other product categories within personal care and home cleaning. And then we are planning on taking this thing global. It is a big global problem. We've developed a solution to this problem that we have proven is scalable. We've got to 30,000 customers in 6 months, where we were profitable in our third month of business. So we're gonna try and launch this thing internationally next year.
Have you been to the market in terms of what's your investor or your capital raising sort of appetite?
Yeah, so we've done two raises now. We've raised about $5 million in total now.
So far?
Yep.
What are the sort of things you need to put in place to get that done?
Yeah, totally. So look, when I first had this idea, before I did the crowdfunding campaign, I went and pitched this idea to every single person I could get to every VC fund, every private equity, all the incubators, all of the impact investment groups, and every single person said no to me. I must have got 100 no's. But I just knew that there was something here, so I just kept persevering through the no's after no after no after no. And I finally came across a guy who said, I got the first yes, right? And it's always the case with everything in life. You get 100 no's, you get one yes, and then the rest of them come.
Someone once said to me really, really something quite interesting. Every time you get a no, you know you're getting closer to the next to a yes.
Yeah, I like that.
And that's a good way of looking at it.
Yep.
It's a bit like having hot, dry days and you need rain. You just know every dry day that just goes past, you're getting one closer to the day it's going to rain.
Yep.
And that's a good way of looking at this.
Mm, totally. So I think to your question, what do you have to do? The first thing is you just have to have perseverance, right? Because you're going to get a heap of no's. And hopefully you learn something from your pitch, from every no, and you tweak it and you iterate it until you get to your yes, right? So that's the first thing you have to do. I think the second thing is you need to have a really robust plan to show investors exactly what you're going to do and how you're going to do it, and make sure that you explain to them how much you understand about the problem. So my first iteration probably was not enough detail as possible. There's a bit of a myth out there in funding land that you should only send a 10-page investment doc, right? 10 slides is you're done. I sent a 95-page document. I sent around 10 slides, got no's. So I went, sat down and wrote the whole thing, everything that I'd thought about how to build this business. And I started sending out 95-page slide decks to investors, and I started getting yeses. So that was interesting.
But yes to the meeting.
Yes to the meeting, and then yes to investments. So maybe that's another lesson there, like buck the trends. The 10-slide investor deck didn't work for me. Not a 95-slide one did.
So you've only been going for 6 months.
Yep.
So what point did you start to look for investors?
So I put $100,000 of my own money in on day one. That ran out pretty quickly because I hired some people.
Did you raise a $750 on your crowdfunding?
So I went out to investors before then. Before the crowdfunding. Got a bunch of no's. I then got introduced to a guy called Rob Chapman, who's the ex-CEO of St. George Bank. He's an Adelaide guy. I got introduced to him through some people in the wine industry. He was one of the early investors in Vino Mofo, and I had a relationship with those guys through the wine business. And he was the first guy that said, yep, I'm in. And so massive thank you to Rob Chapman, was the first believer in this thing. And he was then able to bring in some other people from private equity and you know, high net worth individuals. And we ended up raising $750,000 in that first round. Friends and family participated in that. My mum and dad put some money in. My big sister put some money in. I already had $100,000 in at that stage. Then we were able to top that up with some high net worth people. Then we went and did the Kickstarter campaign, which proved the concept, proved there was a market. And then in about July of last year, we did our second raise in the middle of COVID. That was a massive learning curve, trying to raise money during a global pandemic. But we were able to bring some VC funds in there. So Kim Jackson from Skip Capital, which is Scott Farquhar from Atlassian's private equity firm, they came in. They were the first ones to write a pretty big check to back us, which was amazing. So we did those two rounds, and then we literally just closed another round probably a month ago. We raised another $2 million. Basically, all of the initial investors went in again, and we brought a few other high net worth individuals in. So we've had quite a lot of success.
And do you think that you'll have to go back?
We are planning. The big audacious idea here is we are planning on handing over ownership of this company to our customers, because I believe that what we are trying to do is build a people-powered solution to this problem, right? I don't believe big business is going to go and solve the plastic problem. I don't believe governments are going to go and solve the plastic problem. I don't believe charities are going to solve the problem. So we are trying to mobilize a mass movement of people to make small changes in their daily purchase habits, which when they add up is a massive change in the impact on plastic. And so the goal is to invite our customers to become owners of our business. So those people who are doing the heavy lifting and are making the change in the world financially benefit from the success of the business.
It's a bit like going to the credit union and borrowing money from a credit union to make you a member.
That's right. That's right.
So you're looking at a membership-based type thing, and that could be as a shareholder.
Correct.
Shareholders and members.
Yep. So we are planning on doing an equity crowdfunding round later this year, which will be the first opportunity for customers to become owners of our business.
That's very cool.
Yeah.
Very cool. Yeah. And I guess we're sort of at the end of our podcast. I mean, there's a lot in this and for everybody to sort of digest. And it's really good. I mean, I normally give, and I'm asking lots of questions, but I normally give everyone an opportunity to ask me a question. So you got one for me?
Yeah. This is an unusual question I ask everyone that I interview to come and work at Xeroco, which is, where are you at on your plastic journey of awareness and things that you're doing in your life? Or, you know, where are you at? What things?
I'm acutely aware of the issue. Mind you, I haven't actually experienced, although other than that story I told you about what I saw in Malaysia, but I'm acutely aware of the pollution issue. I'm sort of acutely aware of the small plastics too that are finding their way back into our own food, into the food chain.
Yep.
I'm acutely aware of my own personal use of single-use plastics. Where I can, I resist buying a bottle of water, or I just won't do it. Generally speaking, you know, at work, I don't have water bottles in my office. I used to have. I had an agreement with this mob who had really good spring water, and they used to just supply me all the time. I never had to buy it, and it went on for years. But I actually stopped that about a year ago. I just don't want that because it was coming in plastic bottles, and I just used to shit me. In terms of, I guess I said right at the beginning of this, more recently I've become aware of, you know, getting shakes and things like that in plastic containers to such an extent I don't want to do it anymore. So that's where I'm at. I'm acutely aware of it. I'm not active in terms of, I'm not an activist, but I wish someone, and I'm glad you're doing this. I mean, I for example, would buy this product for sure. I mean, I would tell my office who buys my stuff. You know, they just basically go after where they've got the supplies in my house. But I'll tell them to have a look at this. And by the way, I wasn't aware of it until a producer got hold of it. One of the things that's interesting to me is that I haven't heard of you prior to this.
Yeah, okay.
And that's, you haven't got to me yet.
Yep.
Through socials.
Yep.
Which is interesting because I'm all over socials. So
yep.
I haven't seen it yet.
Yep.
So I'm obviously aware of it now.
Yeah, yeah.
Through our production crew here. But
yep.
I think you could probably do more
totally
marketing in this regard.
The days are early.
Yeah, no, totally. So you've only been around a while, but like in terms of awareness,
yep.
I think you could do a lot more.
Yeah.
So, to answer your question, I'm acutely aware of the problem. More than I am aware of the solution.
Mm.
I'm sure there's other solutions too, but this is a solution. I think this solution is quite elegant.
Mm. Thank you. Well, now you've got a solution for home and office.
Yeah, no, totally. And actually, I'm looking at them. I would have those in my home. So I'd have that zero hand wash thing in my house.
Yep.
Because it looks fine. It's cool.
Yeah.
I'd have, like, I have, we own accommodation businesses, my son and I. And I would put it in all my hotels and stuff like that too. Because, you know, that's why I asked about the price.
Yep.
I was, you know, that old horse called self-interest.
Yep.
In every race. I was flogging him when I wanted to find out what's your price. Is it equivalent?
Yep.
And we actually put that thank you soap in our accommodation places. So
yep.
If it's the same price, because
yep.
we're always trying to try and make as much money out of these rooms as possible, especially during the COVID, because travel has been pretty tough.
Yep, totally.
But we would put that stuff in there because it's actually quite a nice looking bottle.
I'm going to hold you that to Mark.
Yeah, no, totally. No, you can.
I'm going to give you the old school hustle after
yeah,
this.
Yeah, no, you can, because we will do it. But no, that stuff we will definitely do.
Amazing.
Very good to meet you, Mike.
Yeah, great
excellent,
to meet you.
Excellent stuff. Great journey. Out there, you've done it all. How old are you now?
38 in a month.
Fuck, you've done a lot. You've lived a lot of lives in 38 years.
I have.
Feel exhausted?
Sometimes I feel a bit exhausted. I do.
You're going to kill it.
Oh, thank you.
You're welcome.
Thanks for having me. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for coming on.
Thanks for listening to The Mentor. Audio and production is by Jess Morley. And production assistants, Jonathan Leondis.
Hold up. When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers. With rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's stamps.com. Code program.
Confidence starts with loving who you are. And when your skin feels nourished and glows on the outside, you naturally radiate confidence from the inside. Give your skin a glow up with Osea's clinically proven Mega Moisture Duo. This ultra-hydrating body care features two of Osea's best sellers, Undaria Algae Body Oil and Undaria Collagen Body Lotion. These seaweed-powered heroes use skincare-level ingredients normally reserved for your face for results you can see and confidence you can feel. Osea has been making clean, clinically proven seaweed-infused face and body care products for over 28 years. This luxurious skincare is vegan, cruelty-free, and climate-neutral certified, so you never have to choose between your values and your best skin. Glow from the inside out. Get 10% off your first order with code GLOW at OseaMalibu.com. That's OseaMalibu.com, code GLOW.